Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
For another week. I hope you're looking after yourself as best you can in this kind of mad time as we all rush around and head towards Christmas. At least that's what I've noticed, is that how many people are rushing around. You ask people how they're going and you can see them go, ooh, like their eyes are rolling, they're kind of grinning, and some people are just hanging in there. Everyone's tired, but everyone's busy, and we put so much pressure on ourselves at this time of the year to get everything done. And it makes me wonder how many of us are probably going too hard, too early, or at least putting ourselves under undue pressure to try and get stuff done because we've forced ourselves into this artificial deadline being Christmas. You know, I actually had to sit down last week and write a few things down and work out, okay, mate, it's great to have the stuff done by Christmas, but do you actually need to? Like, is it really important to have these things done and these things achieved and these things little ticked off in your own little boxes before Christmas Day? Half of them, the answer is no. But yet everywhere I go, it's just rush, rush, rush. And it becomes contagious. I don't know about you, but I feel it when I go to the shopping centre. You can just feel people busy, 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 rushing around, moving a little bit quicker than usual. And it does become contagious. It's that emotional contagion. I don't know who starts it, but we're kind of in that period now where it's a mad sprint to the finish, and I just hope people aren't going to fall over heading into Christmas. You know, conserve some energy for your holiday. You know, I've been guilty of this myself in the past where I get to a holiday and just collapse into it. And then by the time you come back from your break and you start up again with work and looking after the kids with the daily routine and everything like that, you actually haven't replenished those energy stores because you went into your break with not enough. So manage it where you can. You know, there's a great phrase that I love: go fast where you must, go slow where you can. Where you get the chance, where we all get an opportunity to just slow things down, take it. You know, we need to take breaks. We certainly need to be focused on being effective and being as productive as we can each and every day. That we know that. That's good for us to have some goals to meet. But at the same time, don't go too hard, eh? Make sure that you look after yourself. And I had a good lesson in that on the weekend for myself, actually, because after 2 years of stopping and starting, we actually had a big fundraiser at our local school. I'm on the PTA. I'm not sure if I've told you that before. I'm on the PTA for my little girl's school just up the road. I want to contribute. I want to involve the community as best we can and get people up and running and getting stuff done. And obviously we want to raise funds to get things done for the school, but also foster that community spirit. And we actually had that in the most beautiful of ways on Saturday at our school colour fun run. I've never been part of one of these before. I did the run with my daughter. It started at the top of a big slide. You slid down and then we all got hosed to get wet. Anyway, off we went down a slippery bank. Long story short, we went through five or six different colour stations and got cornstarch coloured, bright coloured stuff thrown at us. I had it in my mouth. I had it all over my head. Shirts were stained, but that's the idea, of course, is that you get really muddy and dirty and full of colour and you have lots of laughs. And it was the best thing. I ran side by side with my six-year-old daughter for the entire run. You know, it's only 4 or 5 minutes long, but we had a blast. We had so much fun. And then I was on the sausage sizzle and we were cooking sausages and handing those out to people. And there was live music. A great local live band was there. And we had some food stalls. And you just looked around and people were having fun and people were relaxed and there was that great community spirit. It really was there. It was evident. You know, I talk about that emotional contagion. Great case in point was this. Everyone was upbeat. Everyone was feeling great. There was lots of laughing. There was so much fun, very few tears. And we know that community spirit is so important. I think probably more so than ever before. Just to know that there are people around, you look around and go, yeah, man, this is my village. I don't know all of these people, but I know that we all share something in common, and that is we want our kids to go well and do well at school, and we want to be there and ensure that we can help in any way we can. Just as an aside, funds raised go towards a garden project up at the school, a ground-to-table kind of a project where the kids will end up being able to harvest their own food. So it goes to a worthy cause, but it's all I thought about all day. Was this, just being involved in this. And it wasn't until Sunday, the day after, that I was kind of basking in the glory of a wonderful day with my family and with some friends and meeting new people. I thought, why was yesterday so special? And, you know, again, classic me, overthinking things when I didn't really need to try and discover why it was so special, it just was. But I came to the realization that I got out of my own head for a day. I was just living in the present moment. The entire day, I just lived in the present moment. How cool is that? And it made me think, man, how often do I actually do that? I spend so much time worrying about what's coming up and how we're going and constantly checking in on my own mental well-being and my own health, and feels like it's a referendum almost on a daily basis, which in some cases is a good thing, but I'm one of those guys that tends to overdo that. But for Saturday, I just got out of my own head. I didn't think about the past. I wasn't worrying about Christmas. I wasn't worrying about buying presents. I wasn't thinking about all the work that I've got to do this coming week or whatever it might be. It was just living in the now, living in the moment. That's what kids do. Hey, that's what kids do. They live in the moment. And so we got a great chance to do that as parents and as adults. And that was really, really special. That will stick with me for a long, long, long time. And I got out of my head. And that was just priceless for me. So we've got some great guests on the program today. A lot to look forward to here on Take It From Us. And remember, of course, you can jump on and let us know your thoughts. Jump onto the Facebook page, Take It From Us. It's time to talk about diabetes. Well, diabetes in New Zealand is a huge problem. And I think pretty much everyone knows that. And one that is only getting worse. There are now more than 250,000 Kiwis with the disease and many, many more who are pre-diabetic. So they're heading towards diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is now described as processed food disease, and in most cases, it's a reversible condition. So we can be optimistic about that, provided, of course, there's a dietary intervention. So to reverse type 2 diabetes, you essentially have to change what you eat, as well as some other things. That's the key plank. And we wanted to talk to a guy called Jared Cannons, who's been doing some tremendous work in his local community in South Auckland. Jared works alongside Dr. Lily Fraser to help people reverse their type 2 diabetes. Jared himself is a skilled chef and runs weekly cooking classes at Tūriki Healthcare in Mangere in South Auckland. He joins the program now. Jared, great to have you on the program. Really want to hear your story. Before you tell us about all of the work and the mahi that you've been doing locally and with so many people, what about your own journey? How did you get to the point where you decided that what you wanted to do was to give back to your local community, but also to help people to manage their diabetes and in some case reverse it?
I started off doing construction, 15 years of scaffolding and working in the mines in Australia. And while I was doing that, I wasn't really taking great care of myself, but everything was readily available. I had, all my food was cooked for me. Lifestyle was pretty easy. The work was intense. It was long days, long hours. So my health took a bit of an impact over the time I was there. And then there was an opportunity to come home because I was actually – my contract was changing to from day shift to night shift. So I did that for a few weeks and just hated it and felt my health. I was starting to go very pale and I was starting to get really ill. And so it was just affecting everything. So I just ended my notice and I quit just out of a whim. And at the time, my partner and I, we'd just had another baby girl. So she was about one, and I'd just come home. And my partner, she still is a GP, and she was into this sort of the low carb, ketogenic. I wasn't really into it. So I came home to be a stay at home dad, and I really loved it. But while I was doing that, it was my partner sort of put it on me. Oh, you really need to learn this, and it's going to be great for our kids. And so, yeah, I slowly sort of just picking out podcasts and different, you know, things offline. And then she mentioned, at the time, she mentioned, oh, there's Precure and what they stood for and what they did. And she said, if you really want to learn something, they've got modules that you could learn or do some study. So I like the concept of the health coach. And you know, because I wasn't really looking after myself really well. So in the process, I started doing the health coaching while I was being a stay-at-home dad and learning myself and changing my health and learning about it and applying it. The plan was never to go into probably what I do now. So this sort of just happened. And just moving along, I really loved cooking the food. I've loved cooking food since I was young. So I was really fortunate. My parents were really big on us learning to cook, and, that sort of resonated with me really, a lot. And then, just moving further and further along, just realized that, my health was getting better. I was loving food. I was loving cooking the food. And then one day we went to a wānanga down in Rotorua at Apu Moana Marae. And the wānanga was about well-being from an indigenous sort of approach and the catering style food. And so my partner said, oh, Jared will cook for everyone. And that was... at that wānanga at the time were a lot of doctors, physio, a lot of professionals doing some work within the indigenous space. And so, yeah, so I ended up cooking that day for about 40 participants that were at the wānanga. And then they asked me at the lunch break when it was time to serve up, would you do a little bit of spiel of what you cooked? And I cooked, just big bulky dishes that were really low carb, really good quality fat, really filling. We even did some dessert. And my kitchen hands were my two baby girls. So they helped. And, a lot of them were really shocked at how much we cooked in such a small time for such a big group. And one of the doctors approached me and said, would you teach this to others? Because you made it look really easy. And I was like, that would be pretty cool. And that ended up back in Auckland and started doing cooking classes for Tipsy Healthcare. And then after that, things got really good. I was actually doing coaching, but unconsciously, I guess is the way you say it, was just coaching about, what we eat, how we do things. And one of the doctors said, would you consider doing, we have a health coach vacancy, would you be interested? And they said, oh, we'll provide training and everything. And at the time, I'd already completed the health coaching study. I was like, oh, I've actually done all the health coaching studies. So they were like, oh, why didn't you say anything? I was like, oh, well, I wasn't really planning to do this. This wasn't actually the ultimate plan. And from there, yeah, it became a full-time gig. And it's just growing. I still continue with the cooking classes, still building on some great relationships. And I really focus, I'm in South Auckland based and working with a lot of our Polynesian and Māori whānau.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's... been amazing, and working with a great bunch of doctors as well that really love the low carb ketogenic way of doing things, and they love the health coaching. So it's made massive moves in the last, especially in the last 12 months, more than anything. And because COVID hit, and that really affected a lot. So we've slowly been able to bring on more health coaches and start getting them, joining the workforce and helping whānau as well. And, built up some really amazing relationships with a lot of our clients and patients and that. And now networking with a few other clinics and the gym over the road, and starting to create a sort of a holistic health sort of program.
So you're driving lifestyle choice and empowering your people to make these changes to look after themselves. So how are you specifically helping those people in our community with diabetes as far as managing the condition and in some cases even reversing it?
Yeah, so, there's a good example of, talking about Pani. Pani was a really great example. She had an out-of-control diabetes. She had no faith in the system, no faith in her doctors. She just got let down by wherever she would try and make change, it just failed for her. And, one of the doctors just referred her on to me and said, would you like to meet Jared and have a go? We first actually met was her coming along to a cooking class instead of coming to a consult. I said, why don't you just come along to the cooking class and we'll meet up there and I'll cook you lunch and we'll have a yarn with the rest of the group, and if you want to continue after, we can. And it was really, really cool because I think she felt really, as soon as we did that, she felt really at ease, realised there was a lot of others in the same sort of boat with her and similar situations. And she realised that there was a lot of questions coming out that she actually was, others were asking, but he really wanted to know the answers to those as well. And then, after we'd cooked a really nice low-carb lunch and that, her and I went for a one-on-one at the park and had a, good old conversation in the park. And then I said, would you really want to know about, your situation and how we can reverse it? And she'd been told by her diabetic nurses and the hospital, she was, at one stage she was told, if you want to reverse your diabetes, you're going to have a bariatric surgery. And that freaked her out. So I just said to her, we can do this through heaps of lifestyle changes, but it takes a lot of hard work and commitment. And I said, if you really, really want to make change now, you and I can start today. And so we just put a few things down on paper for her that she could just work on just for the first sort of month. And they were really simple things like, committing to the good sleep, doing a little bit of walking. Plus she had her job, which was quite physical as well. She was, and she was helping home help. So she did a lot of work with older whānau members that obviously were struggling to look after themselves. So she would go clean their bathroom, make sure that they were getting clay and all that. So I had a flow-on effect from our coaching. So she started to actually coach some of the old co-master within, and she felt really awesome about doing that. So it was really cool. And she started to slowly share her own story and as she was progressing. And we had a few relapses in the process, and we did talk about it being really hard, and there'll be times where we're going to come up against obstacles, and sure enough, these happened. She went back to, we actually got her medication reduced dramatically. She was really doing well on her low-carb approach. She was getting extra energy. She started to do a lot more walking. Even our consults, instead of meeting at the clinic, we'd just go for a walk, and that would be our consult, going for a walk and a good old yarn and talk about what was happening for herself. It was a real positive consult. and just reaffirm that she was doing what she was doing right now was the best that she could do, and we worked on that as we went along. But when she went to one of her other appointments at the hospital, she had to be a diabetic nurse and all that, and they said, oh, you know, you can do this and you can do that. You don't have to do this particularly like that. So she took on all that. She really put it all on board, and she did do it. And it actually had a relapse, and her diabetes became pretty bad. It was actually worse than when we started. And her medication was increased, which obviously caused more stress, and she was very frustrated. She disconnected from talking to me for a while because she was embarrassed because of all the hard work she'd done, and she'd made that relapse. So I just keep being persistent, just dropping, like, you know, hello, how you doing? Hope you're doing okay. I'm still here when, you know, if you need anything. It took a bit of time. And then, yeah, she just had a visit with her doctor, and they said, oh, how are you going with Jared? And she was like, oh, she explained what had happened. And they said, oh, Jared, he's an open book, you know, just, he doesn't judge anyone for anything like that. Just go and see him or give him a ring, and he'd be happy. He'd love to talk to you. And she did. She reached out again, and that was really, really cool. And, you know, this time we were able to put in a few things. And I said, next time you have a doctor's appointment at the hospital, would you like me to come with you? So then, you know, we can talk about what we're doing, and they can have a little more understanding around your lifestyle. Because what they were saying is not entirely wrong, but it obviously didn't suit your environment, and it had a, you know, a bad effect on what we were trying to achieve. She's moved to Australia. We reversed her diabetes. We got off all her medications. And then she went to Australia, and she was having some problems over there, but we continued to coach just through FaceTime or Messenger, and we still do. We just had a catch-up last week. Same again, she had some issues. She had some nerve issues, and it was affecting her sleep and her back, muscles, and she thought she was going to have to go and have this quick-time operation. It actually affected her sugars, her stress levels. So we made a few inquiries for her, and she did it really well herself in the end. And she connected with someone without able to support her from a holistic approach to help her with this problem. And after one visit, she had the best sleep ever the next night. She had a little bit of discomfort, but it improved throughout the week. And then she went back for another visit, and all the pain she was feeling disappeared. And while she was doing this, I was getting her to test her blood sugars as well to keep, you know, following her glucose. And they started to decrease dramatically. And then, but she didn't stop eating a low-carb approach. And in that gap of when we were still, when she went to Australia, she started to do Zumba classes, dancing. She was walking with her family to go to the gym, doing aqua aerobic. She was just getting out there doing amazing things.
So she had the energy to do all of these good things because of the fact that she changed what she was eating. I'm fascinated, Jared, what's been the change in her mental well-being because of the work that you've done with her?
Yeah, that's been super amazing. Her mental clarity or her outlook on things has changed so much. She, you know, because she used to get four to 5 hours sleep was as good as it would get for her. And I think when we were able to get solutions around that, that made a massive impact on her mental makeup or approach to things. She was very clear. She was making better choices with food. Day in and day out, because she was far more rested, and her mental clarity, you know, she was really just, even when you talk to her, she just really knew exactly what she wanted to do and how she wanted to do it, And if she wasn't sure, she was reaching out, asking the right questions, and then implementing whatever she needed to. And the food was, she really mastered that. That was a real key for her. Because she was, because that was one of the things that really put her in a bad space after her visit to the hospital, because it was food ultimately that she changed. And so she went, when she went back to a very low carb, ketogenic sort of way of eating, we messed around with the macros and we talked about how, her fat and protein really needed to dominate her plate. And so we started off really, really high fat and a moderate protein sort of approach and a very low carb approach. And from there, she found that her energy level started to rise really quickly and she was maintaining them for a long time. And she was like at a time where her job was quite physical, she was feeling that like all the way she was eating was really complementing her work, but she was finding she still had heavy energy, so she started to really, I really want to go to the gym now, or I want to start getting into some walking or running. I even went for a walk with her, and at one stage we were going up Mangere Mountain, I couldn't keep up with her.
Yeah.
And I was like, she was like, come on, you're slowing me down. So I was like, oh, I thought I was being nice. And, yeah, she was the one, she was giving the
great pain. Great. Hey, Jared, just one final question, because I know that you work with people in groups, and we know... Well, you tell us, what is the power of community connection, particularly for people who are struggling? And in this case, we're talking about diabetes.
Yeah, it's a big power, actually. So having community sort of the group that we work with, the first thing is when you get to sit down in those groups, you get to realize that you're not alone on these journeys. So you find people sharing similar stories to your own, and you learn about the struggles that they're going through too, and it really empowers you to know that, hey, you know, that person's going through the same thing as me right now. You know, and then some of the solutions that we come together as a group, some of the solutions that come out of it, I know I could try this or I could do this. So, you know, you have them sitting around and they're making mental notes about things that they could try. And even when, before I close the group, I always talk about, so from today's group, what are you going to go? I want everyone to go around the room and commit to one thing this week that you're really going to do positively to support your outcome. And there's some really great things come out of it. And then when we start the group, we always follow up how we finish off the week. So it's like, so what did you do that really worked? And what did you find hard? Because we've always got to learn from those hard things as well. So we can keep building on them and so they become easier for others as well. And ultimately, you see a drop. You see a drop in those diabetes numbers, but you see an improvement in diet. You see an improvement in energy. You see a great improvement in sleep. And just stress levels just totally become so low or non-existent for some of the whānau members. And it just has massive flow-on effects for everyone. And it just makes me even happy to know that, you know, what we're doing is working, and, you know, it makes me want to come back more and more and help. You know, you just feel more geared up by all these great examples of, you know, lifestyle struggles, turning them around into positive. And, yeah, for me, it's like, it just feeds my fuel for me to see them doing really well. Yeah.
Jared, look, I know diabetes is an awful beast, and we need to try and tame it as best we can. And the work that you are doing has just been really awesome and really inspiring. And just for helping so many of our community with diabetes to help, you know, not only manage it, but more importantly, give them a sense of hope and give them a sense of optimism. And we know this is a reversible condition. And thanks for sharing Pani's story with us today. And keep up the great mahi, man. Take care.
Thank you, man. Thank you for that. Appreciate your time.
Yeah. but we got different reasons for that.
From us, that one is Mr. Jones by Counting Crows. Let's talk about sportingmemories.co.nz. It's a brand new website that's been established by Richard Wright, and Sporting Memories is a plan to take reminiscence therapy to community centres and to rest homes in New Zealand. Man, it sounds awesome. Sounds like a lovely way for people with dementia, loneliness and depression to share sporting memories and spend time connecting with other people. And as we know, that is just so, so important, particularly for older people. So let's bring in Richard Wright to have a chat with us on the program about sportingmemories.co.nz. Richard, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for asking me.
Hey, tell us about Sporting Memories, and we'll get to the work that you're doing, but how did it come about?
Okay, so the Sporting Memories Foundation was established in the UK about 10 years ago now, 2011, and it came out of a project in Scotland where they were looking at engaging football clubs and communities together, and the sort of power of nostalgia and power of getting these people together to talk about and sort of getting what they call grumpy old men out of their homes and talking about their sort of mental health and physical health and sort of that sort of thing. The pilot went well. Before you know it, it sort of then grew around Scotland, and before they knew it, it was growing across England. So over the last 10 years, that Sporting Memories network, there's now a Sporting Memories Scotland, Sporting Memories England, Sporting Memories Wales, and they've got over 160 clubs now, pretty much the length and breadth of the United Kingdom. And these Sporting Memories clubs meet sort of weekly, fortnightly sessions, to basically getting people together. And it's that power of sort of reminiscence therapy is what they call it. So the power of getting people together to have a chat, to talk about sport. And as it's sort of grown, they've grown into creating a weekly newsletter, which goes out, the Sporting Memories Pink, it's called. And, you know, they've got involved with a lot of other charities now and sort of got some pretty high-hitting ambassadors, former rugby players, former footballers that have kind of got behind their charity. So I discovered it about 2 years ago now. It was a colleague of mine. I work for AUT and I'm in the Centre for Active Ageing. So I do a lot of work with older adults and also a lot of work with sports. So a former colleague of mine sort of placed it on my lap and said, have you heard about this in the UK? That's where you come from. You know, are you aware of it? Do you think it could work in New Zealand? And my straight away was, of course, you know, this country loves its sport. And it's known for its sport and its identity. It's also, obviously, I know a lot about the issues around loneliness in older adults and the dementia and the mental health crisis, which is in sort of in the news today as well, I see. So, you know, the timing seemed to be quite good. It was during the pandemic, so people were locked down. And I said, well, how is it operating in the UK? And they said, oh, well, they've gone online and they're still connecting with people online, and they've created these kit bags to send out to people to sort of keep them attached and sense of belonging. So we got in contact with the guys in the UK and the co-founder Chris Wilkins and said, hey, you know, does this operate anywhere else in the world? Would you be adverse to us Kiwis over here having a go at it? And he basically jumped at the chance. He said, it's great. They actually have been approached by people in Australia. There's a couple of sessions running out of Adelaide, South Australia. And he said they've been looking, you know, they were just coming up to celebrate their 10th anniversary, and this is the perfect timing for them to look beyond the borders of the UK. So we've been working now with each other essentially for the last 12 months, just doing a bit of due diligence, just making sure, you know, how would it run in terms of the structure. I'm fortunate, again, with my position at AUT, we have an exercise group called the Never Too Old Exercise Program. So I was able to connect with them and say, hey, you know, to their members who are all locked down, unable to sort of get active, do you think this is something that they would like, would be of value to them? And we ran a couple of pilot studies in a couple of MetLife care facilities on the North Shore of Auckland, just bringing people together. This was between lockdowns, this one. We actually got it just before the Delta lockdown, and we were able to run a couple of weekly groups in these two rest homes. And yeah, you could see straight away, you know, the smile it puts on people's faces, the sort of the power of reminiscing, the power of sharing stories. So we have the tagline, you know, it's where sharing is caring. And it's about that sort of power of getting people just to reminisce, just to replay memories. And you can give them a scene, you know, it could be something that was in the news, an All Blacks test that happened over the weekend, for example. And then you get them to relate it to what it means to them, which is just so powerful. And, you know, we all know the value of it's good to talk and getting people talking. And in the UK, predominantly they found it was men, as they said. It was older men that didn't necessarily have the support networks that their wives or the widows have.
So how does reminiscence therapy help with the short-term memory and seeing people thriving in the short term?
Well, it's about what we know from the studies into sort of dementia is, you know, the short term goes first and they remember the long term. So you've got people who, you know, are struggling in terms of short term memory, but can name their first 15 of rugby when they're at school, down to their birthdays and star signs. And what we know about, you know, the brain is a muscle. So it's about using the brain. So if you're using the brain to think about these old memories that are still fresh in your life, it'll help sort of strengthen in terms of maybe maintaining your short memory. And, you know, it's about age friendly. It's about living well. It's about just giving them, you know, so even if you've got people coming in that don't remember they were here, and even if they share the same story that they shared last week, to us, that's not important. It's about them sharing. It's about getting them up. We know the power of belonging. And sport, you know, brings people together. It brings communities together. It brings clubs together. So, you know, getting people to sort of remember and then helping them build new memories. So, you know, if they can remember the squad from 1964, you know, well, let's talk about the squad from 1994 and, you know, help them build memories and see where they are, where there might be gaps.
Mm. And what results have you seen?
In New Zealand, we haven't seen yet. We're still obviously in the very early stages of getting these up. But, you know, we talk really closely with those running the clubs in the UK. And my job as a researcher as well coming in was first thing I did was look at the research that's been done on this. And they have teamed up with dementia professors in the UK and also a guy from the London School of Economics to show that there is value in this. And the story that Chris always shares and the story that I share is, you know, of the guy who was basically they were doing a session on cricket and one of the guys sits in the room, doesn't say much, notoriously hard to sort of connect with until he gets a cricket ball in his hand and you see him playing with the cricket ball and you see him. And again, the facilitator who's trained to identify these things and go, oh, you know, have you got something to say here, something to share, you look familiar with that. And before you know it, he's reminiscing about bowling to the great Don Bradman, you know, which nobody knew. And again, even his family, because the facilitators then share that with his family. Did you know your dad bowled to Don Bradman when he was touring? No, he's never said that. So that power of actually bringing families together and giving them something to share is the one that I've seen. And, you know, we can see from the groups where we do active recreational therapy with them, you know, you can see the value of even just spending 30 minutes with them. The difference in being able to move their arm slightly to in 30 minutes being able to pass a ball around the circle comfortably, you know, it's there, it's evident in your own eyes to see.
Sounds amazing. I mean, it makes total sense, doesn't it, from a scientific point of view and from a behavioural point of view as well. I'm just thinking, for those people who aren't interested in sport, how we could help them so that they could participate and be active in these amazing sessions. What else do you think we could do with this beyond sport?
Well, sport is kind of a great conversation, because, you know, those people that don't like sport can talk about why they don't like sport, and they've got memories right. about sport. You know, why sport? Oh, no. So sport is that great one that gets people talking, I think, regardless. You know, there are lots of communities. We recently hosted a age-friendly Auckland symposium at AUT, and, you know, we had a dance group in, the Golden Swallows cultural group, Chinese age group. And, you know, we had other sort of, there's the senior choirs out there. So music is another one, you know, and again, being on the radio, you'll know, you know, so music is another one that everyone's got a genre of music. It's got a taste of music. They've got music they don't like, they dislike. They've got their memories of their first song, their first album. So certainly music is one which, and there is sort of the group that we work, the secretary of the foundation we've set up, or Cadia, she's one of the leading diversional recreational therapists in New Zealand. And, you know, so she is the expert in that space. I'm, you know, definitely not qualified in that space, but the whole diversional therapy of just using leisure, using, you know, memories, to help people, to give people a smile. And I think what we've also seen and what they've seen in the UK, and I expect to see here in New Zealand, is you get the partners of people living with dementia, partners of people that are living with people with depression and loneliness. And, you know, again, I've gone through severe anxiety myself, and, you know, the pressure it puts on your family because you're not yourself for a bit. You know, for me, it's going for a run. It's getting out. It's watching sport, you know, just escaping from reality for a while. But what they found in the UK is, you know, these clubs need volunteers to help facilitate them. So our charity isn't going to come in and run these sessions. We facilitate, we find locals, and it's very much working within the communities and getting local leaders. So those people that, you know, have seen the value of it through their family come in, and they're, even if they're the ones that run the halftime, you know, tea break, or, you know, come up with ideas for fundraisers to help the club to operate. So, you know, it's got to be inclusive to everybody. Where we kind of, the only rule about exclusion is in terms of the size of these groups. We've known, again, from the UK that anything bigger than 15 is too many people in one session. So you've got to keep the groups manageable, and also you've got to keep them local. You know, the power of this is getting local people together in a local space, local community hall. And, you know, so again, if there's somebody that's not local, we need to find out where they're based and set one up in their locality, so that ease of access.
Mm. And you've started up in Auckland, but is the goal to try and get it to as many centres around New Zealand as you can?
Certainly. You know, we're ambitious. We've gone with Auckland just because it's where most of the trustees are based, and it's that kind of convenience at the moment. And, you know, we've got what we call the first wave of clubs. We are desperate to try and get out before Christmas. And we know Christmas and New Year's is a time where, again, families come together. But if you haven't got family, it can be a horrific time. So we're deliberately trying to get some things ready and up and running for this Christmas. The goal would then be, yeah, to go far and wide. I'm already working with somebody who's up in Alzheimer's Northland. And we've identified, you know, Whangarei and some of the Northland communities. We've been contacted by somebody down in Taranaki. And, you know, how we envision it is, again, that's how, once we've got the first wave up and running, then we get sort of, we expect people to be coming to us left, right and centre saying, can we have one here? Can we have one there? And our one sort of requirement is we need to make sure that it can be run what we call socially sustainable, which means it's got to be free. It's got to be friendly, like family friendly. It's got to be functional, and it's got to be fun. So we can't have somebody having a great idea, setting one up, and then a fortnight later, they're moving on because they become, you know, it becomes a routine. It becomes into people's belonging, you know, just like sport does. And when, you know, the sport has to stop because of a pandemic, people don't know what to do with themselves. So we need to make sure that these clubs, for us to support them, have a strong enough support network within the community that they can keep running indefinitely. But, you know, there's, again, that's where we're really learning the lessons that they've learned in the UK. We can't have one popped up and then, oh, it goes because somebody left town and they were the ones running it.
Yeah, yeah, and the power of sport, you're so right, the power of sport is just enormous. But I was thinking, you know, it could be music, I think, as you mentioned, it could be movies, it could be TV, it could be food, toys, games, anything. We love talking about our childhood, and that's where the great essence of ourselves comes from, doesn't it, from those memories that we've got that we're so attached to from when we were kids. It must be really inspiring and rewarding, Richard, for yourself to see the glint in someone's eye, to go from that kind of dull, opaque uncertainty to bang, there's a light switch going off. You must see that.
I've at the moment, I'm seeing it with, obviously, I had to get a board of trustees together, you know. I had to go around and just do the due diligence and just go to rest and say, do you think this would work? Because, you know, very careful. I know just because I'm super passionate about it doesn't mean everyone else is. So I've seen the glint. I'm yet to really see the glint because we haven't got the clubs running. But I've heard about the glint in the eye, and I'm very much looking forward to being there to see some of these first clubs, because I can imagine it. You know, I can picture my grandfather, who would never have gone to a rest home in his life. You know, he was both my grandfather and my grandmother who took me to football matches in the UK when I was growing up. You know, they lived and died and essentially in their houses in the 90s. They didn't want to be put into homes, you know, and I can imagine this working. And another one of our trustees, Tom Mayo, who got involved because, again, his dad, he was like, my dad, this would have added, like, you know, years to my dad's life. So, you know, seeing the glint in the eyes of just the people who've said, Rich, how can we help you with this, is kind of the satisfaction I get at the moment.
Great. Look, thanks so much for your time. You can find Richard online, www.sportingmemories.co.nz. This is such an amazing thing that you're doing, and we know that it works from elsewhere. We have a shared culture. A lot of our sporting culture is shared with England, so if it works there, you've got to think it works in New Zealand, and it will work in Australia. Richard, great visionary stuff, and I really hope it goes well for you. And thanks very much for joining us on Take It From Us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Swagger, shit, talent, more than anything can vouch. Lil' mama, you up, what's happening? Ghetto fire, I'll make you proud. So stun-delicious, I love it. Let's at least work something out. Miss Thang, $1 million game. Coke bottle frame, make my wall of fame. Let me know your name, I control the rain. I can make it better, matter of fact, I'll make it wetter. Stormy weather with this feather, all because you hot as leather. If you may, lady, let me play, baby. Make my way, baby. You don't like it, send it back, it's okay, baby. Use the key. Touch a diva, give me a fever. If I could freak ya, give me the word, I mean the word.
Excuse me, little mama, if I may. Girl, let me touch you like nobody can. I wanna show you I'm a gentleman. Girl, let me be the one to hold your hand.
From us, Be On You, Flo Rida. Time to wrap our program, and we love to finish with our shout out to Sheldon Brown, former host of the program. That is our very special Sheldon shout out. Karen, who are we talking about this week?
Well, Ken, we always love hearing from people on the show, and I had a lovely message from a lady called Matty, and Matty loves the show and wanted to give a shout out to her Auntie Sharon. Auntie Sharon's been helping out with the family this week while Maddie's mum's been in hospital. So Maddie's been spending time at hospital, and Auntie Sharon has been helping out with the kids, getting them off to school, making the meals, and picking them up for school. So really, you know, family helping out in times of need. So that's what a Sheldon shout out's all about, is just people doing something and us thanking them and saying thanks to Auntie Sharon. So yeah, she's helping out Maddie, and hope your mum gets well, Maddie.
Yeah, nice, Karen. Thanks. I was talking to a lady last week, and I asked her, I said, so what is it that you do, or what is it that you do during the day? And she looked a bit sheepish and said, oh, I'm just a stay-at-home mum. And I said, look, there's no just about it. You can't say it like that's the toughest job in the world, is to be a stay-at-home parent. Hey, we need to recognise that.
Yeah, we do need to recognise. There's a lot of work goes into raising children, and we may think it's just part of being a wife and a mother or caregiver, but no, it's a job for sure. It's hard work, especially if you've got several and with special needs or, you know, difficulties, as we know from the show, plenty of people do. So, yep, it's hard raising kids.
And you're well versed in that, and I'm kind of getting there with a 4-year and a 6-year old. I'm starting to feel like I know what I'm doing after a few years. But look, my eyes have truly been open to the work and the graft. The reward is enormous, of course, when you're at home. But just the last 2.5 years with lockdowns, I've had to do a lot of parenting on my own at times, and I found it really challenging, really difficult. At times I've really struggled with it, but I think I'm a better guy for that now. I'm a better dad, better partner, and just for knowing that, yeah, man, if you are a solo parent, or you're doing a lot of solo parenting and you're raising children, it's enormously hard work. It's the toughest grind work I've ever done.
And we're coming out the other side. We've got a 21-year-old, but you realise actually that the parenting doesn't sort of stop. Yeah, I think you know, you're always going to be the parent. So you always worry about them, but they go off and make their own way, but you're always there.
Karen, my dad just recently turned 83, Brian Douglas Johns, and he said, Kent, he said, just so you know this, mate, you never ever stop being a parent.
Yeah.
And he's 83 and his youngest is 43. So there we go. So well done to everyone who's out there just doing their best. I mean, that's all we can ask of ourselves at this time, isn't it? That we do our best every day. And some days our best just has to be good enough. Thanks, Karen. And that's our Sheldon shout out for this week. Thank you to Jared Cannons and to Richard Wright for being on our program. We are Take It From Us. We're very proud to bring you this program every week. We hope you've enjoyed this week's edition, and we'll talk to you again soon.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page. Take it from us.
Worse, I gotta go to the studio with Bruno Mars on another planet. Don't get mad, I'm just saying. Don't believe it.